What do you want to know?
I need to talk to Stackhouse, Luke said. How do I do that?
Her phone, Evan said. She has a special phone. She called him before they attempted, you know, the extraction. I saw her put it in her coat pocket.
I'll get it,
Wendy said and turned back toward the sheriff's station. Don't just bring the phone, Luke said. Bring her.
Luke, she's been shot.
We might need her, Luke said. His eyes were stony.
Why?
Because it was chess now, and in chess you never lived in the move you were about to make, or even the next one. Three moves ahead, that was the rule, and three alternates to each of those, depending on what your opponent did. She looked at Tim, who nodded. Bring her. Cuff her if you need to. You're the law, after all.
Jesus, what a thought,
she said and left. Now, at last, Tim heard a siren. Maybe even two of them. Still faint, though. Luke grabbed his wrist. Tim thought the boy looked totally focused, totally aware, and also tired to death.
I can't get caught in this. They have my friends. They're trapped, and there's nobody to help them but me.
Trapped in this institute?
Yes. You believe me now, don't you?
It'd be hard not to after what was on the flash drive. And all this. What about that drive? Do you still have it? Luke patted his pocket. Mrs. Sigsby and the people she works with mean to do something to these friends of yours so they end up like the kids in that ward?
They were already doing it, but then they got out, mostly because of Avery. And Avery was there because he helped me get out. I guess you'd call that irony. But I'm pretty sure they're trapped again. I'm afraid Stackhouse will kill them if I can't make a deal.
Wendy was coming back. She had a boxy device that Tim supposed was a phone. There were three bleeding scratches across the back of the hand that held it.
She didn't want to give it up, and she's surprisingly strong even after taking a bullet.
She handed Tim the gadget and looked back over her shoulder. Orphan Annie and Drummer Denton were supporting Mrs. Sigsby across the street. Although she was pale and in pain, she was resisting them as much as she could. At least three dozen Dupre townsfolk trailed behind them, with Doc Roper leading the pack.
Here she is, Timmy,
Orphan Annie said. She was panting for breath, and there were red marks on her cheek and temple where Mrs. Sigsby had slapped at her. But Annie looked not the slightest bit discomposed.
What do you want us to do with her? I suppose stringing her up is pretty much out of the question, but ain't it an attractive idea?
Doc Roper set down his black bag, grabbed Annie by the serape, and pulled her aside so he could face Tim.
What in God's name are you thinking of? You can't transport this woman anywhere. You're apt to kill her.
I don't think she's exactly at death's door, Doc,
Drummer said.
Hit me a lick like to break my nose.
Then he laughed. Tim didn't believe he had ever heard the man laugh before. Wendy ignored both Drummer and the doctor.
If we're going to go somewhere, Tim, we better do it before the state police get here.
Please. Luke looked first to Tim, then to Doc Roper.
My friends will die if we don't do something. I know they will. And there are others with them, the ones they call the Gorks.
I want to go to the hospital, Mrs. Sigsby said. I've lost a lot of blood. And I want to see a lawyer.
Shut your cake hole. I'll shut it for you,
Annie said. She looked at Tim.
She ain't hurt as bad as she's trying to make out. Bleeding's already stopped.
Tim didn't answer immediately. He was thinking of the day, not so long ago, when he had swung into Sarasota's Westfield Mall to buy a pair of shoes. Nothing more than that. And a woman had run up to him because he was in uniform. A boy was waving a gun around up by the movie theater, she said, so Tim had gone to see, and had been faced with the decision that had changed his life. A decision that had, in fact, brought him here. Now he had another decision to make. Bandage her up, Doc. I think Wendy and Luke and I are going to take these two for a little ride and see if we can straighten this thing out.
Give her something for pain, too,
Wendy said. Tim shook his head. Give it to me. I'll decide when she gets it. Doc Roper was looking at Tim, and Wendy, her too, as if he had never seen them in his life.
This is wrong.
No, Doc.
It was Annie. And she spoke with surprising gentleness. She took Roper by the shoulder and pointed him past the covered bodies in the street, and at the sheriff's station with its smashed windows and doors.
That's wrong.
The doctor stood where he was for a moment, looking at the bodies in the shot-up station. Then he came to a decision.
Let's see what the damage is. If she's still bleeding heavily or if her femur's shattered, I won't let you take her.
You will, though, Tim thought, because there's no way you can stop us. Roper knelt, opened his bag, and took out a pair of surgical scissors.
No,
Mrs. Sigsby said, pulling back from Drummer. He grabbed her again immediately, but Tim was interested to see that before he did, she was able to put her weight on her wounded leg. Roper saw it, too. He was getting on, but he still didn't miss much.
You're not going to do field surgery on me in this street.
The only thing I'm gonna do surgery on is the leg of your pants, Roper said. Unless you keep struggling, that is, do that, and I can't guarantee what will happen.
No, I forbid you to—
Annie seized her by the neck.
Woman, I don't want to hear no more of what you forbid. Hold still, or your leg's the last thing you'll be worrying about.
Get your hands off me.
Only if you'll be still. Otherwise, I'm apt to wring your scrawny neck.
Better do it, Addie Goolsby advised. She can be crazy when she gets one of her spells.
Mrs. Sigsby stopped struggling, perhaps as much from exhaustion as the threat of strangulation. Roper scissored neatly around her slacks 2 inches above the wound. The pant leg collapsed around her ankle, exposing white skin, a tracery of varicose veins, and something that looked more like a knife slash than a bullet hole.
Well, sugar, Roper said, sounding relieved. This isn't bad. Worse than a graze, but not much. You got lucky, ma'am. It's already clotting.
I am badly hurt,
Mrs. Sigsby cried.
You will be if you don't shut up, Drummer said.
The doctor swabbed the wound with disinfectant, wrapped a bandage around it, and secured it with butterfly clips. By the time he finished, it seemed that all of Dupre, those who lived in town at least, were spectating. Tim, meanwhile, looked at the woman's phone. A button on the side lit up the screen, and a message reading power level 75%. He powered it down again and handed it to Luke. You keep this for now. As Luke put it into the pocket containing the flash drive, a hand tugged his pants. It was Evans.
You need to be careful, young Luke. If you don't want to have to hold yourself responsible, that is.
Responsible for what? Wendy asked.
For the end of the world, miss. For the end of the world.
Shut up, you fool,
Mrs. Sigsby said. Tim considered her for a moment. Then he turned to the doc. I don't know exactly what we're dealing with here, but I know it's something extraordinary. We need some time with these two. When the state cops show up, tell them we'll be back in an hour, two at most. Then we'll try to get on with something at least approximating normal police procedure. This was a promise he doubted he would be able to keep. He thought his time in Dupre, South Carolina was almost certainly over, and he was sorry for that. He thought he could have lived here, perhaps with Wendy. 39. Gladys Hickson stood in front of Stackhouse at Parade Rest, her feet apart and her hands behind her back. The fake smile that every child in the Institute came to know and hate was nowhere in evidence. You understand the current situation, Gladys?
Yes, sir. The back half residents are in the access tunnel.
Correct. They can't get out, but as of now, we can't get in. I understand that they have tried to, shall we say, fiddle with some of the staff using their psychic abilities.
Yes, sir. It doesn't work.
But it's uncomfortable.
Yes, sir. A bit. There's a kind of humming. It's distracting. It's not here in admin, at least not yet, but everybody in front half feels it.
Which made sense, Stackhouse thought. Front half was closer to the tunnel. Right on top of it, you could say.
It seems to be getting stronger, sir.
Maybe that was just her imagination. Stackhouse could hope so, and he could hope Donkey Kong was right when he insisted that Dixon and his friends couldn't influence prepared minds, not even if the Gorks were adding their undeniable force to the equation. But as his grandfather used to say, hope don't win horse races. Perhaps made uneasy by his silence, she went on.
But we know what they're up to, sir, and it's no problem. We got him by the short and curlies.
That's well put, Gladys. Now, as to why I asked you here, I understand that you attended the University of Massachusetts in the days of your youth.
That's correct, sir, but only for 3 semesters. It wasn't for me, so I left and joined the Marines.
Stackhouse nodded. No need to embarrass her by pointing out what was in her file. After doing well in her first year, Gladys had run into fairly serious trouble during her second. In a student hangout near the campus, she had knocked a rival for her boyfriend's affections unconscious with a beer stein and been asked to leave not just the joint, but the college. The incident had not been her first outburst of bad temper. No wonder she'd picked the Marines. I understand you were a chem major.
No, sir, not exactly. I hadn't declared a major before I decided to leave.
But that was your intention?
Yes, sir, at that time.
Gladys, suppose we needed, to use an unjustly vilified phrase, a final solution concerning those residents in the access tunnel. Not saying it will happen, not saying that at all, but supposing it did.
Are you asking if they could be poisoned somehow, sir?
Let's say I am. Now Gladys did smile, and this one was perfectly genuine, perhaps even relieved. If the residents were gone, that annoying hum would cease.
Easiest thing in the world, sir. Assuming the access tunnel is hooked up to the HVAC system, and I'm sure it is.
HVAC?
Heating, ventilation, and air conditioning, sir. What you'd want is bleach and toilet bowl cleaner. Housekeeping will have plenty of both. Mix them up and you get chlorine gas. Put a few buckets of the stuff under the HVAC intake duct that feeds the tunnel, cover it with a tarp to get a good suck going on, and there you are.
She paused, thinking.
Of course, you might want to clear out the staff and back half before you did it. There might be only one intake for that part of the compound. Not sure. I could look at the heating plans if you...
That won't be necessary, Stackhouse said. But perhaps you and Fred Clark from janitorial could get the, proper ingredients ready. Just as a contingency, you understand.
Yes, sir, absolutely.
Gladys looked raring to go.
Can I ask where Mrs. Sigsby is? Her office is empty, and Rosalind said to ask you if I wanted to know.
Mrs. Sigsby's business is none of yours, Gladys. And since she seemed to be determined to remain in military mode, he added, dismissed. She left to find Fred the janitor and start gathering the ingredients that would put an end to both the children and the hum that had settled over front half. Stackhouse sat back in his chair, wondering if such a radical action would become necessary. He thought it might, and was it really so radical, considering what they had been doing here for the last 7 decades or so? Death was inevitable in their business, after all, and sometimes a bad situation required a fresh start. That fresh start depended on Mrs. Sigsby. Her expedition to South Carolina had been rather harebrained, but such plans were often the ones that worked. He remembered something Mike Tyson had said. Once the punching starts, strategy goes out the window. His own exit strategy was ready in any case. Had been for years. Money put aside. False passports, 3 of them, put aside. Travel plans in place. Destination waiting. Yet he would hold here as long as he could. Partly out of loyalty to Julia, mostly because he believed in the work they were doing. Keeping the world safe for democracy was secondary. Keeping it safe full stop was primary. No reason to go yet, he told himself. The apple cart is tipping, but it hasn't turned over. Best to hang. See who's still standing once the punching is over. He waited for the box phone to give out its strident brr, brr. When Julia filled him in on the outcome down there, he would decide what to do next. If the phone didn't ring at all, that would also be an answer. 40. There was a sad little abandoned beauty shop at the junction of US 17 and SR 92. Tim pulled in and walked around to the van's passenger side where Mrs. Sigsby was sitting. He opened her door, then pulled the slider back. Luke and Wendy were on either side of Dr. Evans, who was staring morosely down at his misshapen foot. Wendy was holding Tag Faraday's Glock. Luke had Mrs. Sigsby's box phone. "Luke with me. Wendy, sit where you are, please." Luke got out. Tim asked for the phone. Luke handed it over. Tim powered it up, then leaned in the passenger door. "How does this baby work?" She said nothing. Simply looked straight ahead at the boarded-up building with its faded sign reading, "Hairport 2000. Crickets chirruped, and from the direction of Dupre, they could hear the sirens. Closer now, but still not in town, Tim judged. They would be soon. He sighed. "Don't make this hard, ma'am. Luke says there's a chance we can make a deal, and he's smart."
"Too smart for his own good," she said, then pressed her lips together. Still looking through the windshield, arms crossed over her scant bosom.
"Given the position you're in, I'd have to say he's too smart for yours as well. When I say don't make this hard, I mean don't make me hurt you." "For someone who's been hurting children."
"Hurting them and killing them," Luke put in. "Killing other people as well."
"For someone who's been doing that, you seem remarkably averse to pain yourself. So stop the silent treatment and tell me how this works."
"It's voice activated," Luke said. "Isn't it?"
She looked at him, surprised.
"You are TK, not TP, and not that strong in TK at that."
"Things have changed," Luke said, "thanks to the Stasi lights."
"Activate the phone, Mrs. Sigsby." "Make a deal?" she said, and barked a laugh. "What deal could possibly do me any good? I'm dead no matter what. I failed."
Tim leaned in the sliding door. "Wendy, hand me the gun." She did so without argument. Tim put the muzzle of Deputy Faraday's service automatic to the pant leg that was still there, just below the knee. "This is a Glock, ma'am. If I pull the trigger, you will never walk again."
"The shock and blood loss will kill her," Dr. Evans squawked.
5 dead back there, and she's responsible," Tim said. "Do you think I really care? I've had it with you, Mrs. Sigsby. This is your last chance. You might lose consciousness at once, but I'm betting your lights will stay on for a while. Before they go out, the pain you feel will make that bullet groove in your other leg feel like a kiss goodnight." She said nothing. Wendy said,
"Don't do it, Tim. You can't. Not in cold blood."
"I can." Tim wasn't sure this was the truth. What he did know for sure was that he didn't want to find out. "Help me, Mrs. Sigsby. Help yourself." Nothing. And time was short. Annie wouldn't tell the state police which way they went. Neither would drummer Addie Goolsby. Doc Roper might. Norbert Hollister, who had kept prudently out of sight during the Main Street shootout, was an even more likely candidate. "Okay, you're a murderous bitch, but I'm still sorry I have to do this. No 3 count." Luke put his hands over his ears to stifle the sound of the gunshot, and that was what convinced her.
"Don't!"
She held out her hand.
"Give me the phone."
"I think not."
"Then hold it up to my mouth."
Tim did so. Mrs. Sigsby muttered something, and the phone spoke. "Activation rejected. You have 2 more tries. You can do better," Tim said. Mrs. Sigsby cleared her throat and this time spoke in a tone that was almost normal.
"Sigsby 1, Kansas City Chiefs."
The screen that appeared looked exactly like the one on Tim's iPhone. He pushed the phone icon, then Recents. There at the very top of the list was Stackhouse. He handed the phone to Luke. "You call. I want him to hear your voice. Then give it to me. Because you're the adult and he'll listen to you. I hope you're right." 41. Almost an hour after Julia's last contact, much too long, Stackhouse's box phone lit up and began to buzz. He grabbed it. "Have you got him, Julia?" The voice that replied was so astounding that Stackhouse almost dropped the phone.
"No," Luke Ellis said. "You've got it backward."
Stackhouse could hear undeniable satisfaction in the little shit's voice.
"We've got her."
"What? What?" At first he could think of nothing else to say. He didn't like that "we." What steadied him was the thought of the 3 passports locked in his office safe. and the carefully thought-out exit strategy that went with them. "Not following that?" Luke asked. "Maybe you need a dunk in the immersion tank. It does wonders for your mental abilities. I'm living proof. I bet Avery is, too." Stackhouse felt a strong urge to end the call right there, to simply gather up his passports and get out of here, quickly and quietly. What stopped him was the fact that the kid was calling at all. That meant he had something to say. Maybe something to offer. "Luke, where is Mrs. Sigsby?"
"Right here," Luke said. "She unlocked your phone for us. Wasn't that great of her?"
Us. Another bad pronoun. A dangerous pronoun. "There's been a misunderstanding," Stackhouse said. "If there's any chance we can put this right, it's important that we do so. The stakes are higher than you know."
"Maybe we can," Luke said. "That would be good."
"Terrific. If you could just put Mrs. Sigsby on for a minute or two, so I know she's all right.
Why don't you talk to my friend instead? His name is Tim."
Stackhouse waited, sweat trickling down his cheeks. He was looking at his computer monitor. The kids in the tunnel who had started the revolt, Dixon and his friends, looked like they were asleep. The Gorks weren't. They were walking around aimlessly, gabbling away and sometimes running into each other like bumper cars in an amusement park. One had a crayon or something and was writing on the wall. Stackhouse was surprised. He wouldn't have thought any of them still capable of writing. Maybe it was just scribbling. The goddamn camera wasn't good enough to make it out. Fucking substandard equipment. "Mr. Stackhouse?"
"Yes. Who am I speaking to?"
"Tim. That's all you need right now. I want to speak to Mrs. Sigsby."
"Say something, but make it quick," said the man calling himself Tim.
"I'm here, Trevor," Julia said. "And I'm sorry. It just didn't work out."
"How?"
"Never mind how, Mr. Stackhouse," said the man calling himself Tim. "And never mind the queen bitch here. We need to make a deal, and we need to do it fast. Can you shut up and listen?"
"Yes."
Stackhouse drew a notepad in front of him. Drops of sweat fell on it. He mopped his forehead with his sleeve, turned to a fresh page, and picked up a pen.
"Go ahead."
"Luke brought a flash drive out of this institute place where you were holding him. A woman named Maureen Alverson made it. She tells a fantastic story, one that would be hard to believe, except she also took video of what you call either Ward A or Gorky Park. With me so far?"
"Yes."
"Luke says that you are holding a number of his friends hostage along with a number of children from Ward A." Until this moment, Stackhouse hadn't thought of them as hostages, but he supposed that from Ellis's point of view...
"Let's say that's the case, Tim."
"Yes, let's say that. Now here comes the important part. As of now, only two people know Luke's story and what's on that flash drive. I'm one. My friend Wendy is the other, and she's with me and Luke. There were others who saw it, all cops. But thanks to the queen bitch here and the force she brought with her, they're all dead. Most of hers are dead, too."
"That's impossible," Stackhouse shouted.
"The idea that a bunch of small-town cops could have taken out Opal and Ruby Red combined was ludicrous. Boss Lady was a little too eager, my friend, and they were blindsided in the bargain. But let's stay on point, shall we? I have the flash drive. I also have your Mrs. Sigsby and a Dr. James Evans. Both of them are wounded, but if they get out of this, they'll mend. You have the children. Can we trade?" Stackhouse was dumbfounded. "Stackhouse, I need an answer."
"It would depend on whether or not we can keep this facility secret," Stackhouse said. "Without that assurance, no deal makes any sense."
A pause. Then Tim was back.
"Luke says we might be able to work that out. For now, where am I going, Stackhouse? How did your pirate crew get here from Maine so fast?"
Stackhouse told him where the Challenger was waiting outside of Alkaloo. He really had no choice. "Mrs. Sigsby can give you exact directions once you reach the town of Beaufort. Now I need to talk to Ellis again."
"Is that really necessary?"
"As a matter of fact, it's vital." There was a brief pause, then the boy was on the secure line.
"What do you want?"
"I assume you've been in touch with your friends," Stackhouse said. "Perhaps one friend in particular,
Mr. Dixon. No need to confirm or deny. I understand that time is short. In case you don't know exactly where they are,
they're in the tunnel between back half and front half.
That was unsettling. Nevertheless, Stackhouse pressed on. That's right. If we can reach an agreement, they may get out and see the sun again. If we can't, I will fill that tunnel with chlorine gas and they will die slowly and unpleasantly. I won't see it happen. I'll be gone 2 minutes after I give the order. I'm telling you this because I feel quite certain that your new friend, Tim, would like to leave you out of whatever deal we make. That cannot happen. Do you understand? There was a pause. Then Luke said, Yes, I understand. I'll come with him. Good. At least for now. Are we done?
Not quite.
Will Mrs. Sigsby's phone work from the airplane?
Faintly, Stackhouse heard Mrs. Sigsby say that it would.
Stay close to your phone, Mr. Stackhouse, Luke said.
We'll need to talk again, and you need to stop thinking about running. If you do, I'll know. We have a policewoman with us, and if I tell her to contact Homeland Security, she will. Your picture will be at every airport in the country, and all the fake ID in the world won't do you any good. You'll be like a rabbit in an open field. Do you understand me?
For the second time, Stackhouse was too dumbfounded to speak.
Do you?
Yes, he said.
Good. We'll be in touch to fine-tune the details.
With that, the boy was gone. Stackhouse set the phone down carefully on his desk. He noted that his hand was trembling slightly. Part of that was fright, but it was mostly fury.
We'll be in touch, the boy had said, as though he were some hotshot Silicon Valley CEO and Stackhouse a paper-pushing underling who had to do his bidding.
We'll see about that, he thought. We'll just see.
42. Luke handed the box phone to Tim as if glad to be rid of it. How do you know he has a fake ID? Wendy asked. Did you read it in his mind?
No, Luke said. But I bet he has plenty. Passports, driver's licenses, birth certificates. I bet a lot of them do. Maybe not the caretakers and techs and cafeteria staff, but the ones on top. They're like Eichmann or Walter Rauch, the guy who came up with the idea of building mobile gas chambers.
Luke looked at Mrs. Sigsby. Rauch would have fit right in with your people, wouldn't he?
Trevor may have false documents, Mrs. Sigsby said. I do not.
And although Luke couldn't get into her mind, she had closed it off to him, he thought she was telling the truth. There was a word for people like her, and the word was zealot. Eichmann, Mengele, and Rauch had run like the opportunistic cowards they were. Their zealot Führer had stayed and committed suicide. Luke felt quite sure that if given the opportunity, this woman would do the same, as long as it was relatively painless. He climbed back into the van, being careful to avoid Evan's wounded foot.
Mr. Stackhouse thinks I'm coming to him, but that's not right.
No? Tim asked.
No, I'm coming for him.
The Stasi lights flared in front of Luke's eyes in the growing gloom, and the van's sliding door rolled shut on its own.
The Big Phone. 1. As far as Beaufort, the interior of the van was mostly silent. Dr. Evans did try to start a conversation once, again wanting them to know that he was an innocent party in all this. Tim told him he had a choice. Either shut up and get a couple of the oxycodone tablets Dr. Roper had provided, or keep talking and endure the pain in his wounded foot. Evans opted for silence and the pills. There were a few more in the little brown bottle. Tim offered one to Mrs. Sigsby, who dry swallowed it without bothering to say thank you. Tim wanted quiet for Luke, who was now the brains of the operation. He knew most people would think him nuts for allowing a 12-year-old to create a strategy intended to save the kids in that tunnel without getting killed themselves, but he noticed that Wendy was also keeping quiet. She and Tim knew what Luke had done to get here. They had seen him in operation since, and they understood. What exactly was that understanding? Why, that aside from having a yard of guts, the kid also happened to be a genuine bottled-in-bond genius.
These Institute thugs had taken him to obtain a talent that was, at least before its enhancement, little more than a parlor trick. They considered his brilliance a mere adjunct to what they were really after, making them like poachers willing to slaughter a 12,000-pound elephant to get 90 pounds of ivory. Tim doubted if Evans could appreciate the irony, but he guessed Sigsby could. If she ever allowed the idea, mental house room, that was, a clandestine operation that had lasted for decades brought down by the very thing they had considered dispensable, this child's formidable intellect. 2. Around 9 o'clock, just after passing the Beaufort city limits, Luke told Tim to find a motel.
"Don't stop in front, though. Go around to the back."
There was an Econo Lodge on Boundary Street, its rear parking lot shaded by magnolias. Tim parked by the fence and killed the engine.
"This is where you leave us, Officer Wendy," Luke said.
"Tim?"
Wendy asked.
"What's he talking about?"
"About you booking a room, and he's right," Tim said. "You stay, we go."
"Come back here after you get your key," Luke said, "and bring back some paper. Have you got a pen?"
"Of course, and I have my notebook."
She tapped the front pocket of her uniform pants.
"But I'll explain as much as I can when you get back. But what it comes down to is you're our insurance policy."
Mrs. Sigsby addressed Tim for the first time since the abandoned beauty parlor.
"What this boy has been through has made him crazy. And you'd be crazy to listen to what he says. The best thing the three of you could do is leave Dr. Evans and me here and run."
"Which would mean leaving my friends to die," Luke said.
Mrs. Sigsby smiled.
"Really, Luke, think. What have they ever done for you?"
"You wouldn't understand," Luke said. "Not in a million years."
"Go on, Wendy," Tim said. He took her hand and squeezed it. "Get a room, then come back." She gave him a doubtful look but handed him the Glock, got out of the van, and headed for the office.
"Dr. Evans said, I want to emphasize that I was here under
protest." "Yes," Tim said. "We got that. Now shut up."
"Can we get out?" Luke asked. "I want to talk to you without—"
He nodded at Mrs. Sigsby.
"Sure, we can do that."
Tim opened both the passenger door and the slider, then stood against the fence dividing the motel from the closed car dealership next door. Luke joined him. From where Tim stood, he could see both of their unwilling passengers and could stop them if either decided to try making a run. He didn't think that was very likely, considering one had been shot in the leg and the other in the foot.
"What's up?" Tim asked.
"Do you play chess?"
"I know the game, but I was never very good at it."
"I am," Luke said. He was speaking low. "And now I'm playing with him. Stackhouse. Do you get that?"
"I think I do."
"Trying to think 3 moves ahead, plus counters to his future moves."
Tim nodded.
"In chess, time isn't a factor unless you're playing speed chess, and this game is. We have to get from here to the airfield where the plane is waiting, then to someplace near Presque Isle where the plane is based, from there to the Institute. I can't see us making it until at least 2 in the morning. Does that sound right to you?"
Tim ran it in his mind and nodded. "Might be a little later, but say 2.
That gives my friends 5 hours to do something on their own behalf, but it also gives Stackhouse 5 hours to rethink his position and change his mind. To gas those kids and just take off running. I told him his picture would be in every airport, and he'll buy that, I think, because there must be pictures of him somewhere online. A lot of the Institute people are ex-military. Probably he is, too."
"There might even be a photo of him on the Queen Bitch's phone," Tim said.
Luke nodded, although he doubted if Mrs. Sigsby had been the type to take snapshots. "But he might decide to slip across the Canadian border on foot. I'm sure he has at least one alternate escape route all picked out, an abandoned woods road or a creek. That's one of those possible future moves I have to keep in mind. Only..."
"Only what?" Luke rubbed the heel of his hand up one cheek, a strangely adult gesture of weariness and indecision.
"I need your input. What I'm thinking makes sense to me, but I'm still only a kid. I can't be sure. You're a grown-up, and you're one of the good guys."
Tim was touched by that. He glanced toward the front of the building, but there was no sign of Wendy yet.
Tell me what you're thinking.
That I fucked him up. Fucked up his whole world. I think he might stay just to kill me. Using my friends as bait to make sure I'll come. Does that make sense to you? Tell me the truth.
It does, Tim said. No way to be sure, but revenge is a powerful motivator, and this Stackhouse wouldn't be the first to ignore his own best interests in an effort to get it. And I can think of another reason he might decide to wait in place.
What?
Luke was studying him anxiously. From around the building, Wendy Gullickson came with a keycard in one hand. Tim tipped his head toward the van's open passenger door, then brought his head close to Luke's.
Sigsby's the boss lady, right?
Stackhouse is just her ramrod?
Yes.
Well, Tim said, smiling a little.
Who's her boss? Have you thought of that?
Luke's eyes widened and his mouth dropped open a little. He got it and smiled. 3. 9:15. The Institute was quiet. The kids currently in front half were asleep, aided by sedatives Joe and Haddad had handed out. In the access tunnel, the five who had started the mutiny were also sleeping, but probably not deeply. Stackhouse hoped their headaches would be fucking them up most awesomely. The only kids still awake were the Gorks, rambling around almost as if they had somewhere to go. Sometimes they made circles, like they were playing Ring Around the Rosie. Stackhouse had returned to Mrs. Sigsby's office and opened the locked bottom drawer of her desk with the duplicate key she had given him. Now he held the special box phone in his hand, the one they called the green phone, or sometimes the zero phone. He was thinking of something Julia had once said concerning that phone with its three buttons. This had been in the village one day last year, back when Heckle and Jekyll still had most of their brain cells working. The back half kids had just offed a Saudi bagman who was funneling money to terrorist cells in Europe, and it had totally looked like an accident. Life was good. Julia invited him to dinner to celebrate. They had split a bottle of wine before and a second bottle during and after. It had loosened her tongue.
I hate making update calls on the zero phone. That man with the lisping voice, I always imagine him as an albino. I don't know why. Maybe something I saw in a comic book when I was a girl. An albino villain with X-ray eyes.
Stackhouse had nodded his understanding. Where is he? Who is he?
Don't know and don't want to know. I make the call, I give my report, then I take a shower. There would only be one thing worse than calling on the zero phone. That would be getting a call.
Stackhouse looked at the zero phone now with something like superstitious dread, as if just thinking of that conversation would make it ring in his... No, he said, to the empty room, to the silent phone. Silent for now, at least. Nothing superstitious about it. You will ring. Simple logic. Sure. Because the people on the other end of the zero phone, the lisping man and the greater organization of which he was a part, would find out about the spectacular balls up in that little South Carolina town. Of course they would. It was going to be front page news across the country and maybe the whole world. They might know already. If they knew about Hollister, the stringer who actually lived in Dupre, they might have been in touch with him for all the gory details. Yet the zero phone hadn't rung. Did that mean they didn't know? Or did it mean they were giving him time to put things right? Stackhouse had told the man named Tim that any deal they made would depend on whether or not the Institute could be kept a secret. Stackhouse wasn't fool enough to believe its work could continue, at least not here in the Maine woods. But if he could somehow manage the situation without worldwide headlines about psychic children who had been abused and murdered, or why those things had taken place, that would be something. He might even be rewarded if he could manage a cover-up that was watertight, although just keeping his life would be reward enough. Only three people knew, according to this Tim. The others who had seen what was on the flash drive were dead. Some of the ill-starred gold team might be alive, but they hadn't seen it.
and they would maintain silence about everything else. Get Luke Ellis and his collaborators here, he thought. That's step one. They might arrive as soon as 2 a.m. Even 1:30 would give me enough time to plan an ambush. All I've got on hand are techs and wide bodies, but some of them, Zeke the Greek, to name just one, are hard guys. Get the flash drive, and get them. Then, when the man with the lisp calls, and he will, to ask if I am handling the situation, I can say it's already handled, Stackhouse said. He put the Zero phone on Mrs. Sigsby's desk and sent it a mental message. Don't ring. Don't you dare ring until 3 o'clock tomorrow morning. 4 or 5 would be even better. Give me enough time. The phone rang, and Stackhouse gave a startled yell. Then he laughed, although his heart was still beating way too fast. Not the Zero phone, but his own box phone, which meant the call was coming from South Carolina. Hello? Is it Tim or Luke?
It's Luke. Listen to me, and I'll tell you how this is going to work. 4. Kalisha was lost in a very large house, and she had no idea how to get out, because she didn't know how she'd gotten in. She was in a hall that looked like the residence corridor in front half, where she had lived for a while before being taken away to have her brains plundered. Only this hall was furnished with bureaus and mirrors and coat racks and something that looked like an elephant foot filled with umbrellas. There was an end table with a phone on it, one that looked just like the phone in their kitchen back home, and it was ringing. She picked it up, and since she couldn't say what she had been taught to say since the age of 4, Benson residence, she just said hello.
Hola, me escuchas?
It was a girl's voice, faint and broken up by static, just barely audible. Kalisha knew hola because she'd had a year of Spanish in middle school, but her scant vocabulary didn't include escuchas. Nevertheless, she knew what the girl was saying and realized this was a dream.
Yes, I can hear you. Where are you? Who are you?
But the girl was gone. Kalisha put the phone down and kept walking along the hall. She peered into what looked like a drawing room in an old-time movie, then into a ballroom. It had a floor made of black and white squares that made her think of Luke and Nick playing chess out in the playground. Another phone began to ring. She hurried faster and entered a nice modern kitchen. The fridge was plastered with pictures and magnets and a bumper sticker that said, Berkowitz for President. She didn't know Berkowitz from a hole in the wall, yet she knew it was his kitchen. The phone was on the wall. It was bigger than the one on the end table, certainly bigger than the one in the Benson kitchen, almost like a joke phone. But it was ringing, so she picked it up. Hello? Hola? My name is... Me llamo Kalisha. But it wasn't the Spanish girl. It was a boy.
Bonjour. Vous m'entendez?
French. Bonjour was French. Different language, same question. And this time the connection was better. Not much, but a little.
Yes, oui, I hear you. Where are you?
But the boy was gone, and another phone was ringing. She dashed through a pantry and into a room with straw walls and a packed dirt floor mostly covered by a colorful woven mat. It had been the final stop for a fugitive African warlord named Badu Bokassa, who had been stabbed in the throat by one of his mistresses. Except he'd really been killed by a bunch of kids thousands of miles away. Dr. Hendricks had waved his magic wand, which just happened to be a cheap 4th of July sparkler, and down Mr. Bokassa went. The phone on the mat was bigger still, almost the size of a table lamp. The receiver was heavy in her hand when she picked it up. Another girl, and this time, clear as a bell. As the phones got bigger, the voices got clearer, it seemed.
Zdravo, kuješ lime?
Yes, I hear you fine. What is this place? The voice was gone, and another phone was ringing. It was in a bedroom with a chandelier, and this phone was the size of a footstool. She had to pick up the receiver with both hands.
Hello, Horyama?
Yes, sure, absolutely, talk to me. He didn't. No dial tone, just gone. The next phone was in a sunroom with a great glass roof, and it was as big as the table it sat on. The ringing hurt her ears. It was like listening to a phone channeled through an amplifier at a rock and roll gig. Kalisha ran at it, hands outstretched, palms tilted upward, and knocked the receiver off the phone's base, not because she expected enlightenment, but to shut it up before it burst her eardrums.
Ciao, boomed a boy's voice. Mi senti? Mi senti?
And that woke her up. 5. She was with her buds, Avery, Nikki, George, and Helen. The others were still sleeping, but not easily. George and Helen were moaning. Nikki was muttering something and holding out his hands, making her think of how she'd run at the big phone to make it stop. Avery was twisting around and gasping something that she had already heard.
Horyama, Horyama.
They were dreaming what she had been dreaming. And considering what they were now, what the Institute had made them, the idea made perfect sense. They were generating some kind of group power, telepathy as well as telekinesis, so why wouldn't they share the same dream? The only question was which one of them had started it. She was guessing Avery, because he was the strongest. Hive of bees, she thought. That's what we are now. Hive of psychic bees. Kalisha got to her feet and looked around. Still trapped in the access tunnel, that hadn't changed. But she thought the level of that group power had. Maybe it was why the Ward A kids hadn't gone to sleep, although it had to be fairly late. Kalisha's time sense had always been good, and she thought it was at least 9:30, maybe a bit later. The hum was louder than ever, and had picked up a kind of cycling beat. She saw with interest, but no real surprise, that the overhead fluorescents were cycling with the hum, going bright, fading a little, then going bright again. TK you can actually see, she thought, for all the good it does us. Pete Littlejohn, the boy who had been beating on his head and going, yeah, 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 came loping toward her. In front half, Pete had been kind of cute and kind of annoying. Like a little brother that tags after you everywhere and tries to listen in while you and your girlfriends are telling secrets. Now he was hard to look at with his wet, drooping mouth and empty eyes.
¿Me escuchas? He said. ¿Hors du mich?
You dreamed it too, Kalisha said. Pete paid no attention, just turned back toward his wandering mates, now saying something that sounded like Stiz's mini. God only knew what the language was, but Kalisha was sure it meant the same as all the others. I hear you, Kalisha told no one. But what do you want? About halfway down the tunnel toward the locked door into back half, something had been written on the wall in crayon. Kalisha walked down to look at it, dodging past several wandering Ward A kids to get there. Written in big purple letters was,
Call the big phone. Answer the big phone.
So the Gorks were dreaming it too, only while awake. With their brains mostly wiped, maybe they were dreaming all the time. What a horrible idea. To dream and dream and dream and never be able to find the real world. You too, huh? It was Nick. Eyes puffy with sleep, hair standing up in stalks and spears. It was sort of endearing. She raised her eyebrows.
The dream. Big house, increasingly big phones. Sort of like in the 500 hats of Bartholomew Cubbins.
Bartholomew who?
A Dr. Seuss book. Bartholomew kept trying to take off his hat for the king, and every time he took one off, there was a bigger and fancier one underneath.
Never read it, but the dream, yeah. I think it came from Avery. She pointed to the boy who was still sleeping the sleep of the totally exhausted. Or started with him, at least.
I don't know if he started it or if he's receiving it and amplifying it and passing it on. Not sure it matters. Nick studied the message on the wall, then looked around. The Gorks are restless tonight. Kalisha frowned at him. Don't call them that. It's a slave word, like calling me a nigger. Okay, Nick said. The mentally challenged are restless tonight. That better?
Yes.
She allowed him a smile. How's your head, Shah?
Better?
Fine, in fact.
Yours?
The same. Mine too, George said, joining them. Thanks for asking. You guys have the dream? Bigger phones and... Hello, do you hear me?
Yeah,
Nick said. That last phone, the one just before I woke up, was bigger than me, and the hum stronger. Then in the same casual tone, how long do you think before they decide to gas us? I'm surprised they haven't done it already. 6. 9:45, in the parking lot of the Econo Lodge in Beaufort, South Carolina. I'm listening, Stackhouse said. If you let me help you, maybe we can work this out together. Let's discuss it.
Let's not, Luke said. All you have to do is listen and make notes because I don't want to have to repeat myself.
Is your friend Tim still with you?
Do you want the flash drive or not? If you don't, keep talking. If you do, shut the fuck up.
Tim put a hand on Luke's shoulder. In the front seat of the van, Mrs. Sigsby was shaking her head sadly. Luke didn't have to read her mind to know what she was thinking. A boy trying to do a man's work. Stackhouse sighed. Go ahead. Pen and paper at the ready.
First, Officer Wendy doesn't have the flash drive. That comes with us. But she knows the names of my friends. Kalisha, Avery, Nikki, Helen, a couple more. And where they came from. If their parents are dead, like mine, that will be enough to support an investigation, even without the flash drive. She'll never have to say a word about psychic kids or the rest of your murderous bullshit. They'll find the Institute. Even if you got away, Stackhouse, your bosses would hunt you down. We're your best chance of living through this. Got it?
Spare me the cell job. What's this Officer Wendy's last name?
Tim, who was leaning close enough to hear both sides of the conversation, shook his head. This was advice Luke didn't need. Never mind. Second, call the plane your posse came down in. Tell the pilots they are to lock themselves in the cockpit as soon as they see us coming.
Tim whispered two words. Luke nodded.
But before they do that, tell them to lower the air stairs.
How will they know it's you?
Because we'll be in one of the vans your hired killers came in.
Luke was pleased to give Stackhouse this information, hoping it rammed home the point. Mrs. Sigsby had swung and missed.
We don't see the pilot and co-pilot, and they don't see us. We land where the plane took off, and they stay inside the cockpit. With me so far?
Yes.
Third, I want a van waiting for us, a 9-seater, just like the one we drove out of Dupre.
We don't.
Bullshit, you don't. You've got a motor pool in that little barracks town of yours. I saw it. Now, are you going to work with me on this, or should I just give up on you?
Luke was sweating heavily, and not just because the night was humid. He was very glad for Tim's hand on his shoulder and Wendy's concerned eyes. It was good not to be alone in this anymore. He really hadn't realized how heavy that burden was until now.
Stackhouse gave the sigh of a man being unfairly burdened.
Go on.
Fourth, you're going to procure a bus.
A bus? Are you serious?
Luke decided to ignore this interruption, feeling that it was warranted. Certainly Tim and Wendy looked amazed. I'm sure you have friends everywhere, and that includes at least some of the police in Denison Riverbend. Maybe all of them. It's summer, so the kids are on vacation, and the buses will be in the town's municipal lot, along with the plows and dump trucks and all the other stuff. Have one of your cop friends unlock the building where they keep the keys. Have him put the key in the ignition of a bus that seats at least 40. One of your techs or caretakers can drive it to the Institute. Leave it by the flagpole in front of the admin building with the keys in it. Do you understand all that?
Yes.
Businesslike. No protests or interruptions now, and Luke didn't need Tim's adult grasp of psychology and motivation to understand why. This, Stackhouse must be thinking, was a child's harebrained plan, only half a step removed from wishful thinking. He could see the same thing on Tim's face, and on Wendy's. Mrs. Sigsby was in earshot, and she looked like she was having trouble keeping a straight face. It's a simple exchange. You get the flash drive, I get the kids. The ones from back half and the ones in front half, too. You have them all ready for their field trip by 2 a.m. tomorrow morning. Officer Wendy keeps her mouth shut, that's the deal. Oh, you also get your piece of shit boss and your piece of shit doctor.
Can I ask a question, Luke? Is that permissible?
Go ahead.
Once you have somewhere between 35 and 40 children crammed into a big yellow school bus with Denison Riverbend on the side, where do you plan to take them? Always remembering that the majority have no mind left.
Disneyland, Luke said. Tim put a hand to his brow, as if he had developed a sudden headache. We'll be staying in touch with Officer Wendy. Before we take off, after we land, when we get to the Institute, when we leave the Institute. If she doesn't get a call, she'll start making calls of her own, starting with the Maine State Police, then moving on to the FBI and Homeland Security. Got it?
Yes.
Good. Last thing. When we get there, I want you there, arms outstretched, one hand on the hood of the bus, one hand on the flagpole. As soon as the kids are on the bus and my friend Tim is behind the wheel, I hand you Maureen's flash drive and get aboard myself. Clear on that?
Yes.
Crisp, trying not to sound like a man who's won the big jackpot. He understands that Wendy might be a problem, Luke thought, because she knows the names of a bunch of missing kids. But that's a problem he thinks he can solve. The flash drive's a bigger deal, harder to dismiss as fake news. I'm offering it to him pretty much on a silver platter. How can he refuse? Answer, he can't. Luke, Tim began. Luke shook his head. Not now, not while I'm thinking. He knows his situation is still bad, but now he sees a ray of light. Thank God Tim reminded me of what I should have thought of myself. It doesn't end with Sigsby and Stackhouse. They have to have their own bosses, people they answer to. When the shit hits the fan, Stackhouse can tell them it could have been much worse. In fact, they should be thanking him for saving the day.
Will you be calling me before you take off? Stackhouse asked.
No, I trust you to make all the arrangements. Although trust wasn't the first word that came to mind when Luke thought of Stackhouse. The next time we talk, we'll be face to face at the Institute. Van at the airport, bus waiting by the flagpole. Fuck up at any point, and Officer Wendy starts making her calls and telling her tale. Goodbye. He ended the call and sagged.
7. Tim handed Wendy the Glock and gestured at their two prisoners. She nodded. Once she was standing guard, Tim drew the boy aside. They stood by the fence, in a blot of shadow cast by one of the magnolias.
Luke, it will never work. If we go there, the van may be waiting at the airport, but if this Institute is what you say it is, the two of us will be ambushed and killed when we get there. Your friends and the other kids as well. That leaves Wendy, and she'll do her best, but it will be days before anyone shows up there. I know how law enforcement works when something comes up outside of normal protocol. If they find the place, it will be empty except for the bodies. They may be gone too. You say they have a disposal system for the... Tim didn't know exactly how to put it. For the used kids.
I know all that, Luke said. It's not about us, it's about them, the kids. All I'm buying is time. Something's happening there, and not just there.
I don't understand.
I'm stronger now, Luke said, and we're over 1,000 miles from the Institute. I'm part of the Institute kids, but it's not just them anymore. If it was, I never could have pushed up that guy's gun with my mind. Empty pizza pans were the best I could do, remember?
Luke, I just don't...
Luke concentrated. For a moment he had an image of the telephone in their front hall ringing, and knew if it was answered, someone would ask, "Do you hear me?" Then that image was replaced by the colored dots and a faint humming sound. The dots were dim rather than bright, which was good. He wanted to show Tim, but not hurt him. And hurting him would be so easy. Tim stumbled forward into the chain-link fence as if pushed by invisible hands, and got his forearms up just in time to keep from dashing his face.
"Tim?"
Wendy called.
"I'm okay," Tim said. Keep your eyes on them, Wendy. He looked at Luke.
You did that? It didn't come from me, it came through me, Luke said.
Because they had time now, a little at least, and because he was curious, he asked,
What was it like?
A strong gust of wind.
Sure it was strong, Luke said. Because we're stronger together. That's what Avery says.
He's the little kid.
Yes, he was the strongest one they've had in a long time. Maybe years. I don't know exactly what happened, but I'm thinking they must have put him in the immersion tank.
Given that near-death experience that enhances the Stasi lights, only with none of the limiting injections. I'm not following you. Luke didn't seem to hear him.
It was punishment, I bet, for helping me get away.
He tilted his head toward the van.
Mrs. Sigsby might know.
It might even have been her idea. Anyway, it backfired. It must have, because they mutinied. The Ward A kids have got the real power. Avery unlocked it. But not enough power to get them out of where they're trapped.
Not yet,
Luke said.
But I think they will.
Why? How? You got me thinking when you said Mrs. Sigsby and Stackhouse must have their own bosses. I should have figured that out for myself, but I never looked that far. Probably because parents and teachers are the only bosses kids have. If there are more bosses, why wouldn't there be more institutes? A car came into the lot, passed them, and disappeared in a wink of red taillights. When it was gone, Luke continued.
Maybe the one in Maine is the only one in America. Or maybe there's one on the West Coast. You know, like bookends. But there might be one in the UK, and in Russia, India, China, Germany, Korea. It stands to reason when you think of it.
A mind race instead of an arms race, Tim said. That's what you're saying?
I don't think it's a race. I think all the institutes are working together. I don't know that for sure, but it feels right. A common goal, a good one, sort of. Killing a few kids to keep the whole human race from killing itself. A trade-off. God knows how long it's been going on, but there's never been a mutiny until now. Avery and my other friend started it, but it could spread. It might be spreading already.
Tim Jameson was no historian or social scientist, but he kept up with current events, and he thought Luke could be right. Mutiny, or revolution, to use a less pejorative term, was like a virus. Especially in the information age. It could spread.
The power each of us has, the reason they kidnapped us and brought us to the Institute in the first place, is just little. The power of all of us together is stronger, especially the Ward A kids. With their minds gone, the power is all that's left. But if there are more institutes, if they know what's happening at ours, and if they were all to band together?
Luke shook his head. He was thinking again of the phone in their front hall, only grown to enormous size.
If that happened, it would be big. And I mean really big. That's why we need time. If Stackhouse thinks I'm an idiot so eager to save my friends I'd make an idiotic deal, that's good.
Tim could still feel that phantom gust of wind that had shoved him into the fence. We're not exactly going there to save them, are we? Luke regarded him soberly. With his dirty, bruised face and bandaged ear, he looked like the most harmless of children. Then he smiled, and for a moment didn't look harmless at all.
No, we're going to pick up the pieces.
8. Kalisha Benson, Avery Dixon, George Iris, Nicholas Wilhelm, Helen Sims. 5 kids sitting at the end of the access tunnel, next to the locked door giving, not that it would give, on front half's F level. Katie Givens and Hal Leonard had been with them for a while, but now they had joined the Ward A kids, walking with them when they walked, joining hands when they decided to make one of those rings. So would Len, and Kalisha's hopes for Iris were fading. Although so far Iris was just looking on as the Ward A kids circled, broke apart, then circled again. Helen had come back, was fully with them. Iris might be too far gone. The same with Jimmy Cullum and Donna Gibson, whom Kalisha had known in front half, Thanks to her chicken pox, she had been around much longer than the usual residents there. The Ward 8 kids made her sad, but Iris was worse. The possibility that she might be fucked up beyond repair, that idea was horrible, Nikki said. She looked at him half scoldingly. Are you in my head? Yeah, but not looking through your mental underwear drawer, Nikki said, and Kalisha snorted. We're all in each other's heads now, George said. He cocked a thumb at Helen. Do you really think I wanted to know she laughed so hard at some friend's pajama party that she peed herself? That's an authentic case of TMI. Better than finding out you worry about psoriasis on your... Helen began, but Kalisha told her to hush. What time is it, do you think? George asked. Kalisha consulted her bare wrist. Skin o'clock? Feels like 11 to me, Nikki said. You know something funny? Helen said. I always hated the hum. I knew it was stripping my brains. We all knew, George said. Now I sort of like it. Because it's power, Nikki said. Their power. Until we took it back. A carrier wave, George said. And now it's constant. Just waiting for a broadcast. Hello, do you hear me? Kalisha thought, and the shiver that shook her was not entirely unpleasant. Several of the Ward A's linked hands. Iris and Len joined them. The hum cycled up. So did the pulse in the overhead fluorescence. Then they let go, and the hum dropped back to its previous low level. He's in the air, Kalisha said. None of them needed to ask who she meant. I'd love to fly again, Helen said wistfully. I would love that. Will they wait for him, Shaw? Nikki asked. Or just turn on the gas? What's your thinking? Who made me Professor Xavier? She threw an elbow into Avery's side, but gently. Wake up, Avester. Smell the coffee. I'm awake, Avery said. Not quite.